signal that was discovered last year in the Fermi Large Area Telescope data, which is an apparent line of gamma rays at 130 gigaelectron volts. So I'm going to spend, I know you've had some talks here, so got a big chunk of review material. I'm going to try to aim for sort of the middle road on how long to take on that, but if you've heard it already or you have more questions, something that hasn't been presented here, you know, shout at me one way or the other to speed up or slow down. Then I'm going to take the point of view that, yes, this is really a real thing, and it has something to do with the dark matter that we believe is surrounding our galaxy, and ask, okay, well, what could that mean? How could dark matter be producing this signal? In particular, talking about the idea that the dark matter itself, rather than being completely inert with respect to the electromagnetic force, has a magnetic dipole moment, and how that would, again, produce such a gamma ray signal. And finally, in order to get the magnetic dipole moment, talk about composite models of dark matter that would actually produce this signal. So to review what, you know, the big exciting news, I guess, of mid-2012 was that there's a putative detection of a narrow feature in the gamma ray spectrum at around 130 GeV. And I'll just go over sort of the papers that announced this detection and how they did it, give a little bit of the evidence that might support a dark matter interpretation of this signal, and give a few that, you know, even if you assume that dark matter is somehow related to or causing this signal, and give a few of the challenges that would face any dark matter explanation. So once again, I'm going to just start with reviewing certainly other people's work analyzing the data, and again, if you've seen it all before, yell at me to speed up, and if you haven't, yell at me to slow down. So the first couple of papers that claimed a detection were by Brinkman et al. And Christoph Venninger, and he was on both of these papers. This is from the second paper. So the idea was to examine regions near the galactic center where the dark matter density ought to be highest, and therefore the signal for any annihilation of dark matter ought to be greatest, and say, well, we know what the astrophysical backgrounds ought to be to this signal, so you can calculate sort of a theoretical signal-to-noise ratio at each, essentially each pixel on the sky, and choose, based on your model of the dark matter halo, what is the best region to look for an optimized signal-to-noise ratio. So that's what they did. This is one particular region that they looked at, assuming one particular dark matter halo. And corresponding to this region, this is the spectrum that they find. So again, this is essentially photon flux versus energy scale on a log scale. And they do a best fit power law to it. Don't know offhand the difference between the purple and the black data points. But in either case, you see there's a little narrow excess compared to the power law right near 130 gigaelectron volts.
And narrow here means unresolved? Is that
what you're saying? No. So by narrow, so it's resolved. Narrow means that the full width half maximum is, I think, between 10 and 15% of the mean value. Okay.
So what's the time scale?
Sorry? Well, it's there in sort of all the data they looked at. As far as we know, right? Okay. Locally, so if you're just going to say, well, what's the odds of a fluctuation there? This is a 4.6 sigma effect. If you take into account the look elsewhere effect, it's about 3.3 sigma. So, you know, it's not gigantic, but if you at least take the local significance, you're sort of approaching a pretty what you might call a particle physics discovery threshold. Yeah?
Is it true that the latest Fermilab phase has outgraded the Huygens phase?
I'll come back to that in a minute. Yeah, I'll get there.
I'm not quite sure I understand the errors that you're pointing there. If you just look at the figure, it seems that the excess is consistent with the background at the 1 and the 2 sigma level. Maybe each 3
days. Yeah, but then the odds that all 3 are above.
Yeah.
That, you know, I didn't do the analysis, so I can't comment on exactly where it gets. That's the quoted significance. The key point is that it's a narrow feature in the spectrum, and for a long time this has been considered a smoking gun signature for dark matter annihilation, because it's not very easy for normal astrophysical sources to produce such a narrow spiky signal, at least in this energy range. Yeah. Yes.
So it's a compact one with this spectrum.
Yeah, well that would be very narrow, right? So the Doppler broadening from that would be, you know, order of 10^-3. So yeah. Okay. So this is just the first, you know, report that started to catch people's attention, right? And as you mentioned in the questions, the situation has evolved, and I'll get there. The next paper that did sort of a similar reanalysis just to verify that, you know, somebody else checking this gets the same thing was by Temple, Hector, and Rydahl. They also sort of did a little bit of a morphological study. This is sort of a map of what they called hotspots around the galaxy, but again, there's sort of the galactic center there. And a couple others a bit more mild. The really different analysis was a few months later was by Sue and Finkbeiner. There are a few extra things that they did. One was to do what you call residual analysis. So instead of just doing a gamma ray spectrum, they could say, well, let's break the spectrum into energy bins. So say 100 to 120 GeVs, 120 to 140, 140 to 160. I think they might have had one more. And with the appropriate normalization, you subtract the bins from each other. And if you're really seeing the same signal, then you should just get noise on the maps, okay, of the galaxy. If you subtract the 120 to 140 GeV bin from anything else, you always get a signal right at the galactic center. And so they said, well, this is sort of a different way to confirm that there's some signal in this energy range coming from the galactic center. And again, they claimed a significance of 5 sigma before the look elsewhere effect. And if, in addition, you do a template fit, so first subtract off, say, well, here's one foreground that we know about, subtract that off. Here's another one, subtract it off. Again, you still get a leftover new signal. Come back. And they said it's even more significant. Another thing that they found when doing analysis of the spectrum is that there's some sort of, suggestion that maybe there's a double line instead of a single line in the spectrum. But that's, there's been some back and forth about that in the literature, I guess. But there's a hint of that. And then coming back to the latest thing that I've heard, anyway, from the Fermi collaboration itself, which is still, as far as I know, a preliminary analysis, I still haven't seen a preprint about it, was a reanalysis of the same data by Fermi. And yes, they have sort of downgraded the significance in that they're claiming that, yes, there does seem to be a signal right near 130 GeVs that, depending on how you process or reprocess the data, looks to be either 3 or 4 sigma. This is not inconsistent with the original reports because they're not using the same kind of search areas. In particular, they're not optimizing the signal-to-noise ratio in the same way. However, there are a couple of, depending on your point of view, you could say caveats or discouraging signs, one is that if you include reprocessing of the data, that seems to shift the center of the line to 135 GeVs, and you wouldn't necessarily expect that in a real signal. And also the reprocessing seems to reduce the significance. And again, you'd rather sort of see it go the other direction.
I'm not very interested in why it's bad that when you do a more careful job
of the signal. Well, it's not particularly bad.
But that just has to do with how much energy you sink with the bottom color.
Yeah.
That's just calibration.
Yeah. But the significance
the
is
the fact that when they did a more careful analysis of the bump, like the modeling the bump a little better, the significance went down. It's a real similar perspective to that.
So, well, you can take it sort of as you like, right? I think right now, based on this, I don't know what the general feeling is. I certainly find it a little bit discouraging myself, but still think it's an interesting enough thing that if it is real, it's still good to think about it. Over here. Yeah, and that's the other thing. Fermi possibly finds other bumps, right? Okay, so that I'm not sure if that's one of the ones they talk about, but there's something there. And I'm not sure if it's quite on this plot, no. But the most significant one they find is near the 5 to 10 GeV range. So again, you can sort of take that how you want, I guess. It maybe they're, well. It's possible that's what's happening. There certainly have been other claims of detections of line-like features at other points in the spectrum too. And so I guess I understand you had a talk about the Fermi results a few weeks ago. Okay, I won't say too much more about that. So, any case. All right, I think it also has been important to ask whether there's an instrumental or other spurious effect. I know that's a curiosity. A lot of the focus has been on sort of the dependence of the signal on the incidence angle of the photons on the instrument, and in particular, comparison to photons from the Earth limb, in other words, photons, the gamma rays that you get from cosmic rays smashing into the Earth's atmosphere. And in the Earth limb, depending on what subset of the data you look at, there is, in fact, a somewhat significant, i.e. bigger than 3 sigma feature, also right around 130 GeV, but it's only at small incidence angles. So here, from those authors, is in sort of a breakdown of the Earth limb photons, but by incidence angle, if you look at all Earth limb photons, you don't really see any line signal at 130 GeVs. But if you're looking at smaller and smaller incidence angles, they're a more and more clear line shows up. On the other hand, at least what the papers were saying this past fall was that the galactic center gamma rays, that 130 GeV line, was showing up at all incidence angles. So even if there's something funny going on, it didn't seem that whatever funny was going on in the Earth limb photons was the same funny thing going on with the galactic center photons.
So it's just a wild coincidence that the instrument is doing funny things.
That's another grain of salt and another bit of queasiness maybe that people have, right? But the thought at the time was that this line in the Earth limb photons might be, an odd statistical fluke. We would want more data to see that. I know Weitz in a recent paper, just a few weeks ago, seems to sort of change his tune a little bit in that, well, he references his earlier paper saying, well, it did look like there might have been an incidence angle dependence in the galactic center photons as well. I go back and look at his original paper in the fall, and he didn't seem to be saying that. So
I think it's a quantitative statement, right? The difference between Bayer's mean, you really need to look at this angle between 30 and 45 to see it.
Yes.
So it is true that when you look at the angle, it's a little more enhanced than if you look at all angles.
But not enough.
But also, it's not necessarily systematic, because that angle is the angle where the resolution is highest. So
okay.
It's not entirely that this is just crazy.
Okay, good.
Especially if it's aligned.
Good. So another thing along with this, too, is Weitzen also has recently claimed that you can see the 130 GeV line, again, at small incidence angles in places where you wouldn't expect to see it from a dark matter signal, like the sun. Okay. So again, it doesn't seem like at least this effect is necessarily big enough to explain the galactic center photons, but it does maybe, say that there are quite a few caveats you might want to keep in mind. Okay. Hopefully, with more data, this will become clear. And also, the HESS-2 experiment being an independent measurement might be a nice control for this. Okay. I should mention, people, of course, have also been suggesting astrophysical sources. So the first one that came out almost immediately, I guess, upon the announced discovery of this was that, well, maybe this is something to do with the so-called Fermi bubbles, which are, of course, another gamma ray source that extends out of the galactic center and has a broken power law. So if you imagine that you've got, instead of a single power law, two power laws that happen to break right near 130 GeVs, and add a little statistical fluctuation right on top of the break, then you'd get something that looks like a line-like feature. That you can actually rule out the Fermi bubbles now pretty well because, well, just the morphology is wrong. And also in particular, Sue and Finkbeiner in their template analysis subtracted out the Fermi bubbles and still found a signal. And, Finkbeiner probably knows the Fermi bubbles as well as anybody. Another group has suggested maybe you could have pulsars producing, an ultra-relativistic but very cold, in other words, a mono-energetic electron wind. Okay, and then inverse Compton would be in a very narrow band. This, well, to me, I'd be very, very skeptical of that, especially given that the signal seems to fill the galactic center pretty well. And if you had more than one pulsar, why would they all be at exactly the same energy? Seems a little weird.
Well, you could have pulsars in your center, but it's exactly misaligned with respect to us.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible, right? But it's...
This is coming from a single pulsar?
Well, the paper was not clear about that. I mean, I think you'd kind of want it to be a single pulsar just to have it mono-energetic enough. But again,
I haven't seen it in this context, but in context of trying to explain gamma rays and ultra-high energy emission experience with pulsars, Spinkowski and Densky, basically were doing these calculations. They never, I think, connected to this one, but they argue about these energies very, very naturally.
Yeah, do they get it in a very narrow energy band?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So, that's one. And then another recent one, again, so looking at another broken power law type explanation. It's talking about, well, let's imagine you have cosmic rays at the so-called knee of the cosmic ray spectrum. Those are protons, mostly. But you can get secondary electrons, again, coming from the knee. Those would be roughly mono-energetic, and then the inverse Compton scattering from those. There, again, though, you need sort of the statistical fluctuation right at the break in the power law. Possibilities, I think, but potentially some issues. It, it is sort of fair to say, I guess, that people didn't really think about this until there was a really narrow feature discovered sort of previously. The thought had been, well, if you do see something that's line-like, then it's probably dark matter. All right, let's see if there is other possible evidence for a dark matter interpretation. So the cross-section that you get from the galactic center data for annihilation into gamma rays, if you assume it's two gamma rays, sigma v is, well, again, depending on your model, between 1 and a few times 10 to the minus 27 centimeters cubed per second. And you might think, well, okay, maybe we can see this somewhere. And you might look at the halos, dark matter halos of galaxy clusters. I've been a couple of different papers that do this. Huang et al. Looked at individual clusters and just found a limit that the cross-section is no bigger than a certain amount, but that's consistent with this cross-section. It's bigger than that. What I found to be a more interesting case is an analysis by Hector Rydell and Temple again, who took six nearby clusters of galaxies and sort of stacked their signals on top of each other and varied the acceptance radiance around the center of the cluster. So you start with a very small radius, and you're just seeing, you know, a little bit of the cluster, and you keep expanding it till you get the whole cluster, and then expand more till you get more and more background. And basically what happens is the significance of the signal increases until you get, well, basically 5 degrees, which should hold, you know, more or less the cluster, and then it decreases as you expand beyond that. And so what you have here are spectra depending on the acceptance radius. I think it's 5 degrees and 6 degrees. Again, flux versus energy. The red line is what they see. The blue dashed line is a scaled down version of the galactic center spectrum. And the gray band is the error bar. So you see it's not very significant, but there is a little bit of the signal. And it sort of intriguingly follows the galactic center spectrum a little bit in that region of interest. Okay, so circumstantial evidence, but at least this weighs on more of the positive side of the balance, unlike some of the instrumental worries. Okay, we can probably say that dark matter subhalos have not been seen in this. The how it's played out in the literature, but basically Soon Finkbeiner claimed that if you look through the unassociated Fermi sources with appropriate characteristics, then you would get, then they actually did detect this 130 GeV line in some of them. Some other papers said, well, actually the spectra don't match what you would expect just from dark matter annihilation in subhalos, although maybe these subhalos are, you know, embedded in stellar clusters we don't know about, which would change things a bit. On the other hand, Hector Rydell and Temple said, well, if you apply selection criteria the way Sue and Finkbeiner did, then it looks like there's a bias that would cause you to see a line that's not actually there. And Hooper and Linden said, well, actually, you know, given the sensitivities, you probably wouldn't expect to see most subhalos yet anyway. So, like I say, a bit controversial, but there's at least one claim that you can detect dark matter subhalos of the galaxy in this line. There are also some null results and constraints, including from looking at the dwarf spheroidal galaxies around the Milky Way. That constraint is not too strong. It's near the thermal relic density annihilation cross-section, which is roughly an order of magnitude larger than what we expect from this signal. But the Fermilat diffuse line search, or diffuse gamma ray search, puts a limit that's very close to the claimed cross-section. So there may actually be a mild amount of tension there. This plot is sort of the, you know, standard exclusion kind of plot, WIMP mass and gamma-gamma annihilation cross-section from Fermi. And shortly after this paper came out, the Resonances blog modified it, plopped in the line that's claimed. So again, some mild tension there. I guess I should also say you can look, well, I'll get to this a bit later, but there's also a constraint on continuum gamma emission if the dark matter were in addition annihilating two other charged particles. Anyway, that'll come up in a bit. Okay, so check the time. There are a few challenges to the dark matter interpretation. If you recall, the cross section was supposed to be maybe a few times 10 to the minus 27 centimeters cubed per second versus the thermal WIMP cross section to determine the relic abundance thermally is 3 times 10 to the minus 26. So, okay, dark matter must be chargeless, so annihilation to gamma ray should, in some sense, be a loop effect, whether it's from, you know, an effective non-renormalizable operator or literally, you know, loops, depending on how you want to look at it. So here, as a cartoon, you just imagine that dark matter is coming in at the bottom, there's something going on in some loop, and gamma ray is coming out. Alternately, this could be, rather than a line due to annihilation strictly to gamma ray, is more of a box-shaped figure from virtual internal Bremsstrahlung. Again, dark matter coming in, some charged particles running around virtually, and then something, decay products, including a photon. But both of these should be suppressed more or less by loop factors. And I think probably one of the first papers sort of talking about particle physics models to produce this gamma ray signals by Jim Klein. He argued, well, okay, if you really have an annihilation to gamma rays coming from charged particles running in the loop, then if these charged particles are only slightly more massive than the dark matter itself, then it works. But you can't have a really big hierarchy in between there. Okay. And here's where these constraints on continuum emission come in, because if these charged particles, you know, if the dark matter can annihilate to the charged particles that are running in the loop, you'd expect to get, say, final state radiation, prompt gamma rays maybe from decays if there are standard model particles, inverse Compton, scattering, Brem. So you can look for that sort of continuum emission, and the cross section for that, again, depending on the analysis, can be only as big as a few times or maybe a few dozens of times as big as the cross section to gamma rays. Okay, if you're going to have a coupling directly to a Z, you're probably going to have a coupling directly to a photon, right? Well, and maybe we can come back to this later. So the point is that in some supersymmetric models where you might, you know, have your favorite dark matter candidate that could annihilate to photons, you actually get way too much annihilation to, say, BB bar pairs. But this also means, again, that if the photons are coming from, you know, some charged particle running in a loop in the dark matter annihilation Feynman diagrams, then that means you can't really be annihilating to those charged particles. So you think, well, for some reason, the dark matter can only couple to charged particles that are heavier than it. Another point that some people have brought up is maybe being a challenge, but I think it's too early to say, is there's a little bit of evidence that the cusp or the center of the signal is about 200 parsecs from the galactic center, which you would not necessarily expect, although, you know, right away, of course, someone has done a simulation of galaxy formation to find, well, maybe there is an offset, but really, I think it's too early to take these sort of morphology issues too terribly seriously. Okay, so onto the particle physics and sort of the end of the review. We now talk about the idea that, okay, maybe it's some magnetic dipole moment interaction that the dark matter has rather than a charge coupling, which it can't have. So I'll just review basically how does the dipole moment operator work, how might it work with the relic density and this gamma ray signal, and then discuss the challenge of getting large enough moments. So, okay, as we know, even uncharged classical matter can have magnetic dipole moments. And for fermions, this is a spin field strength coupling of this form and that Feynman rule. In particular, we're going to be looking at a transition magnetic moment. In other words, the one state of dark matter comes in and a second state comes out. And really, we're also going to be, since we're talking about the standard model, this is going to be a hypercharged magnetic moment. So if there's a certain magnetic moment, mu gamma, for coupling to photons, then multiply that by minus tan theta Weinberg, and you get the dipole moment for the Z. This has been studied by many authors in the past in terms of direct detection. In particular, if you have dark matter scattering from nucleons via a dark matter's dipole moment, well, your nucleon or your nucleus has both charge and dipole, and depending on the nucleus, one coupling or the other would dominate. But assuming sort of the canonical density of dark matter, in other words, that this is all the dark matter that there is, then the dipole moment of dark matter has to be very small, less than a few times 10 to the minus 5 nuclear magnetons. However, if the dark matter's dipole moment is one of these transition moments, then there's only so much kinetic energy to, you know, excite the dark matter from one state to the other as it bounces off of the nucleus. So as long as the mass gap between the dark matter states is bigger than about 150 keV, then you can have larger dipole moments for the dark matter, up to about 1 over T. Okay. And you can run through the same process with electric dipole moments. The story is pretty similar. We're actually going to be considering sort of a lower density, in other words, that the active part of the dark matter, which has the dipole moment, is only a fraction of the total amount. That would allow an even larger magnetic dipole moment. But in the end, we're going to be interested in a mass splitting between the two states of dark matter that's much too large to ever see. So this component of dark matter would essentially be sterile from the point of view of direct detection. Okay. So we want to ask, what's the relic density of the dark matter that's causing the gamma ray signal? And how can it reproduce the gamma ray flux? Well, okay, so the gamma ray flux is proportional to sigma v for annihilation to two gammas, plus, you know, if in this case, since we're coupling to hypercharge, you can also have annihilation to one gamma and one Z. That only counts half as much because it's only half as many photons. But at the same time, if this dipole dark matter is not going to be overabundant, in other words, there's not going to be more than the total amount of dark matter there should be, the total annihilation cross-section should be bigger than, in fact, the annihilation to photons and Zs. If you just add it up, you don't get that anything as large as 3 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. And just remember, again, the relic abundance of any species is inversely proportional to the cross-section. So we need to make sure that the total annihilation cross-section is at least as big as the standard canonical cross-section for dark matter, otherwise you'd have too much. One thing you can do is say, well, we have multiple species of dark matter, call them chi1 and chi2, and if they're co-annihilations into standard model particles, which you can get as they come in, coupled to a virtual photon or Z, and get charged matter out, that's one way to increase the total annihilation cross-section. And the nice thing about it, as pointed out by these authors, is that if you adjust the mass splitting between these two states, well, say chi1 is our dark matter that we want to stick around today, and chi2 is more massive. If chi2 is more massive enough, then there's less of it when chi1 needs to be annihilating. So you need to, in order to get the right relic density of chi1, you need to increase the magnetic dipole moment, which goes along and increases the annihilation cross-section to gamma-gamma. So, sorry, yeah, co-annihilations like that.
So that's just that.
Yep.
You can't have spin while continuing to produce spin part.
Right.
So it's a pi naught gives us the mechanics. This pi naught is a superstring. So close to the natural part, there's a natural connection key. Normally, this puts the K rate. I suppose we over the quantum numbers of pi naught. What quantum
number? Oh, okay.
It's got to be spin 0, spin 2.
Well, in this case, I'm assuming they're Majorana fermions. They're not decaying, they're annihilating.
Okay.
What?
Why?
Well, in this case, it's because we're just building a model that works, right? I mentioned a paper by Jim Klein that talked about this, and he was working with scalar dark matter. You can pick and choose.
Spin zero.
Yeah, sure.
It goes through a bit. The scale is correct.
It doesn't matter what the initial states are. The only thing that matters is what is the state you're not with.
Right.
As long as you can form a single state, done. You can do that. And even if
the
power
was
fermions,
you
just look at the
S
wave, and that's it.
Yeah. No, I mean, in fact, first of all, if it's dark matter, you don't want it to be decaying too fast, right? But another thing is, we don't, have great data for the morphology of this, but it's, what we can pretty much say already is it looks, the morphology is much more like an annihilation signal that goes like the density squared rather than decay. No, doesn't look like that. Okay. So I'll continue. So this is actually sort of a comment that Jim Klein, Guy Moore, and I had sort of been thinking about at the same time Ite and Neil Weiner had, which is that if let's rethink about this relic density idea and just imagine that our sort of active piece of dark matter really is annihilating predominantly by into photons and Zs. That annihilation cross-section is proportional to the fourth power of the dipole moment. And the flux today, if you assume again, since the number density of these is essentially a fraction of the total dark matter is inversely proportional to the total annihilation cross-section, then the total gamma ray flux from annihilation to gamma rays would go like mu to the minus 4. And you just equate this to the observed gamma ray flux, and you find that the magnetic dipole that you need is about 2 over a TeV. And this is fairly large for particles of mass around 100 to 150 GeV. So what happens in this picture is that this active dark matter or the part of dark matter that's annihilating the gamma rays is a subdominant component of the dark matter. And you know, you have a little bit of freedom. Maybe there's also a little bit of co-annihilation, which reduces the fraction of it a little bit more compared to this. But I think I'll have up in a slide or two with these numbers of this magnetic dipole moment. The active dark matter is about 10% of the total. I should also mention, and there's the annihilation. Another way you might have subdominant dark matter, and again, due to Itai and Neil Weiner, is that you have really the dark matter is co-annihilating, like we talked about on the previous slide early. That turns off now because only one of the two states of dark matter remains. Then the gamma ray flux from annihilation of just that first state, like this, ends up being, well, independent of the dipole moment, as long as it's large enough to get reasonable relic abundance. Okay, and again, this could be, I think, could it make up the whole amount of dark matter? I don't remember, but it could also be subdominant. So let's now ask, how might you build dark matter with a magnetic dipole moment? So if you want to do this perturbatively, here's a list of possible ingredients. And you have some fermionic dark matter, chi. Let's assume it's Majorana, just for the sake of argument, so it can annihilate against itself. And then you've got some additional charged particles, hypercharged scalar phi and a fermion psi, and then a Yukawa coupling. And these two loop diagrams will give you a magnetic dipole moment for your dark matter particle chi of this order at one loop. Okay. It's difficult to get a large enough magnetic dipole moment perturbatively using this kind of construction. You need the mass of the charged particles in the loop have to be bigger than the dark matter mass, but it can't be too much bigger. You can do it.
I disagree okay. with
the qualification. The qualification? Okay, let me put it this way. You can get a large enough dipole moment, but if I understood your paper right, you need to additionally consider, you know, higher, even further higher derivative operators like Rayleigh operators.
You can do it.
But,
You can do it
too. Yeah, I know. We ended up lumping it all together. But yeah, that's right. And I think my point is that even the perturbative setup gives you, you know, a lot of. I want the right way to phrase this. The perturbative way gives you. But even the perturbative way includes further higher derivative operators, higher dimension operators. So it's not as clean as you might hope. And if you're going to do that anyway, normally I would say I don't want to touch composite or strongly coupled stuff because it's messy. But if the perturbative way is going to be a little bit tricky, you know, you might need to push the couplings large, and deal with the higher dimension operators, then let's see also what composite models might do. Okay. So that's what I want to talk about. Okay, so the motivation or the idea is that, you know, neutral baryons in the standard model, like the neutron, they have magnetic moments that look like basically the charge of their constituents divided by the mass of their constituents, summed over the constituents. So we can try to do the same thing with dark matter in a confining gauge group. Let's choose SU2 for simplicity. And the matter charged under this gauge group will be a scalar S and a fermion psi with hypercharge, which could be any sort of odd half integer. And these are going to lead to dipole moments under hypercharge of, well, this 1 over TeV order. Okay. Now you can look at what do you get after confinement. There are a bunch of neutral mesons. The one we're going to focus on is the fermionic one, eta, which is a bound state of the S scalar and psi, but there are also scalar mesons, which, well, can be made heavier if you include, for example, a quartic interaction for S and look at the spin-spin interactions of the fermions. Okay. There are also, well, okay, in SU2, it's a little bit harder to tell the difference between mesons and baryons, but there are baryon-like states which are charged as well, which will come up later. But I guess I should say it's this state eta that we're looking at as being one of the components of dark matter. As you remember, only a transition magnetic moment is allowed by direct detection. If you have just strictly a magnetic moment of this size, we should have seen it a long time ago. So we're going to add an additional Majorana singlet that's got a Yukawa coupling to S and psi. And after confinement and S and psi become the eta fermionic mesons, you get a mass mixing due to that Yukawa coupling. And so you get now a transition magnetic moment. And in fact, if you assume, just for simplicity, that your theory respects parity, then you get an exactly diagonalizable mass matrix with 3 Majorana fermions. Okay. The lowest state is mostly composite. The most massive state is mostly this Majorana singlet chi, and the state in the middle is purely composite. Okay. And you can, in fact, plot out, well, how strong is the transition magnetic moment? So we estimate what's the magnetic moment of the eta based on comparisons to nuclear physics, and then based on the mass mixing, you can see, well, what's the transition moment between, say, the first and the second state as a fraction of the original composite fermion's magnetic moment. So what we have here is that fraction as a function of the percent mass splitting between the first two states of dark matter, and 4 different ratios of the mass of the chi and the mass of the eta before you take mixing into account. And so depending on the parameters, you can get, you know, quite a large fraction of the original magnetic dipole moment into the mixed state. Okay, now this came up already earlier. There are actually many other couplings between the dark matter and the standard model in the effective field theory of the strongly coupled system. There are, for example, Yukawas in the dark sector between the chis, the dark matter states, and, say, the other dark mesons, the eta tildes. And in order to prevent annihilation to sort of one of these dark mesons, eta tilde, and a photon, which should have a large cross-section, you need the mass of the eta tilde, which you expect to be roughly similar to the mass of the original composite eta meson, which is itself equal to the mass of chi 2, should be bigger than twice the mass of our dark matter candidate, just to forbid it kinematically. But okay, so we get rid of that. But there's also potentially, since this eta tilde is made out of charged constituents, like the pion, it can decay to 2 photons. And so if this sort of annihilation is resonant, that can be important. Okay. And as mentioned before, there's also Rayleigh operators, which contribute directly to the cross-section to gammas. And again, here we're getting into the realm where it is harder to compute things. In the end, there are essentially many, what you might think of as many contributions to the effective dipole moment. Okay. But in the end, you can reasonably get, you know, the relic abundance and this Fermi gamma ray signal all together. What we're kind of excited about is that there are some potentially spectacular signals of this model at the LHC. In particular, these dark mesons would be produced via, you know, annihilation of a quark and a C anti-quark into gamma Z, which sees the constituents of the dark matter at those energies, and which then sort of hadronizes in the dark sector. So you could see dark matter and dark matter excited states, which produce monophotons or monojets and missing energy. But what's even more visible in some sense is production to two of the other dark mesons, the eta tildes, which again decay into pairs of photons, each pair of which has the same invariant mass squared. So you get not only, you know, these nice pairs of photons, but a direct measurement of sort of the mass of one of these states. And the cross sections, we've only done just sort of a rough estimate. They're sort of near interesting levels, even potentially for going back and mining LHC data that's already there, but certainly for the next run in a couple of years. You can also produce the dark baryons, and then, you know, in order to make sure that these dark baryons aren't hanging around today being massive charge particles that we don't see, there must be some sort of non-renormalizable coupling to standard model charge particles. Therefore, if you produce these things in the LHC, when they decay, you're again going to now get sort of multi-photons and multi-leptons, at least some particular ones of the dark hadrons. Others probably going to produce sort of, well, something that's going to be buried under standard model backgrounds. But the point and the thing that we are excited about is at least the possibility that some of these signals are pretty clear. Yeah.
In recent papers from CMS and others, when you limits on your magnetic field, you have seen pretty substantial.
Well, I think that's probably pretty model dependent. So, yeah, I have to look at that later. So, right, so you decays like this or even more complicated ones. Okay, that's basically all I was planning on saying. Probably the first time in my life I've finished under time. In any case, I reviewed some, well, possible evidence and maybe some reasons to be skeptical or worried about a line in gamma rays from the galactic center at 130 or thereabouts GeVs. How having a magnetic dipole moment for dark matter might be one way to achieve that. And then again, one way to achieve having that magnetic dipole moment through composite dark matter. This might be, if we're lucky, I guess you could say, the first non-gravitational detection of dark matter, and if so, it would indicate, even if not, you know, some composite thing like this, some kind of more rich dark matter physics rather than just sort of a single sterile particle floating around. So from that point of view, I think it's worth at least getting a little bit excited about the possibility, and thanks for your time. Well, right, so Fermi's still collecting data, and hopefully their next pass will give us a little bit clearer picture, but also the HESS-2, which is an air Cherenkov telescope, is sensitive in this energy range. and should also be able to tell us a lot more. Yeah, that I don't know about for sure, but at least they'd be able to tell us if there's something near there. Okay, so if this were purely an instrumental effect in Fermi, then we'd probably be able to rule that out. And I guess I should also say, Sue and Finkbeiner have proposed in one of their papers, well, if Fermi used a different scanning strategy, they'd be able to clear this up very quickly. But I don't know. Maybe you heard a few weeks ago that they were going to do that or not, but I kind of doubt that Fermi would do that.
From what they say, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But it requires changing the orientation of the telescope.
Yeah.
Alternative models that are not composite
negative dark matter that are proposed to explain
730 GeV.
There are.
What's the
zoo of the
most?
More than countable right now. But okay, there's one sitting in the other side of the room, right? So there are perturbative models of magnetic moments. Like I said, you can just sort of put in slightly more massive charge states, and then there the big work is not getting the signal, but getting the massive charge particles to go away and not be hanging around causing problems. I mean, there are probably 50 papers on this by now, right, at least.
Not all of which are right.
Not all, that's right. Not all of them are right. I mean, there are some that, you know, just say, well, if the coupling is so big, then this would happen, but then there's no easy way to get that. And so, but yeah, there's quite a few.
One of
those
slides, you have this extra bump, and you had the profile of this intensity of this 130.
This one?
Yeah.
Okay.
So how it changed with the distance from the center of the galaxy?
Okay, so as I should say, this the number of events we're looking at is kind of low. So I would say any look at the morphology of this is going to have big error bars on it, but basically it falls off roughly about a kiloparsec or 1.5 kiloparseks out.
So it goes like parallel?
You mean in the, like as a function of distance from the galactic center? It follows the density squared of the dark matter halo, right? So, at this point, it's way too early to say, okay, well, we can really fit a specific, or we can take the data and determine a function. What can be said at this point is that the standard halo profiles that you sort of get out of simulations, including sort of the favored fit from like the Via Lactea 2, are consistent. But it's not really consistent with a decay of dark matter, which looks like 1 power of density. Okay, it needs to be more cuspy than that. It's more like density squared.
So, as I understand it, it takes 2 photons through carbon plus carbon minus loop on top of carbon plus carbon minus carbon. So we need to embed
well, okay, if you were looking at a decay, and you certainly could do something like that. There probably are papers that have talked about this. But that's within the realm of possibility. But again, of course, you've got to make sure that they're you know, a bit more massive than the dark matter particle, and that they're not stable. And that's the, well, right, but in the early universe, they would have been produced at some point. I guess, do I say, I think you certainly could get that to something like that to work. Well, it doesn't have to be the whole standard model.
All these business, no matter how you call it, what you do, you just need a charge state. That's
yeah.
It. A couple of charge states, dark matter, you get all those operators.
Yes.
Whether you like it or not. You get a couple of photons, you get a couple of two photons. That's it. You can complicate the model more and complicate the model less, but all that you need is a charge
yeah.
state that is a little bit above your dark matter.
So that's a little case.
Yeah.
Okay, there's a question in the back. Who's been waiting patiently?
Yeah, so I don't know too much about dark matter, so I'm not even sure if this question exists, but I was wondering, in both the perturbative model we looked at and also this composite model, you considered, well, so some kind of scalar coupled to a fermion.
Okay, sure.
So what, I mean, so you're sort of considering fermion dark matter. What if it was a boson? Is that possible?
Yeah, sure. You could do something like that. And in fact, like I said, some of the other papers specifically trying to fit this signal start with scalar dark matter instead.
Okay. Because, so in principle, might it still be possible to get is it any obvious reason that we rule out getting this magnetic dipole moment or otherwise the conservative model if you said had a boson?
I don't think there's any particular problem with it. Again, it's just doing it perturbatively, you need to push the coupling sort of toward the edge of the what you consider perturbative.
That's not true.
That's not true? Okay, well, maybe we can talk a little later.
Strong coupling with perturbative. It's not the same thing. There's a 4-pi
okay.
difference.
4-pi
large number.
Yeah, no, it's true.
So what about like Higgs bosons, for example? It's a good
one. Well, with Higgs's or
so if you had some scalar in your composite particle coupled
right.
with a vector boson, say. I mean, then I think of course you have to consider the spins and whatever and
yeah, sure.
Do you need it's possible to say a vector boson coupled to a scalar?
Yeah, I don't think there's necessarily anything problematic about that.
Okay. So just considering the fermion is sort of simplicity or
Or personal choice or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any further questions?
Okay, thank you.